Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan on this Sunday morning when we're down to only two sleeps until the budget, and that 25 billion surplus in the budget is naturally taking up much of our newspaper print this morning. First to the Business Post with its headline, 28 billion budget day bonanza. The paper says the government is planning for a universal €250 energy credit, a double child benefit payment, extending free public transport to children under nine, and the extension of a temporary VAT cut on gas and electricity. The Sunday Times leads with speculation that the pension will rise by at least €12 per week alongside cuts to income tax, the universal social charge and inheritance tax. The Sunday Independent off-lead says the government parties are at odds over social welfare hikes and lump sum payments to new parents. Fine Gael is seeking a €15 increase in the pension, but reportedly wants to lower hikes for the job seekers allowance. For its main story, the Sunday Independent says Health Minister Stephen Donnelly has intervened in the construction of the National Children's Hospital by seeking a meeting with the contractor's Dutch parent company, according to sources there. The Daily Mail headlines with the legal bills and costs rising at a leading disability charity. The Sunday World has an interview with magician Keith Barry, who is appealing for the Gardaí's cold case unit to look into the death of his grandfather, who died during a burglary at his home 15 years ago. And the Irish Sunday Mirror details the charging of six men and a teenager over the alleged torture of a woman in Dublin this week. Over in the UK, the escalation crisis in the Middle East appears on the front pages, with the Telegraph reporting that US President Joe Biden last night hailed Israel's assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah as quote unquote justice for Nasrallah's many victims. The Observer, meanwhile, leads with Iran's supreme leader saying the assassination will, quote unquote, not go unavenged as fears of a spiralling conflict in the Middle East grow. Joining me now to discuss all of that and more, I have Professor Ray Murphy, former UN peacekeeper and now with the Irish Centre for Human Rights at University of Galway, Gráinne Ní Fhéidh, news reporter with the Press Association, Dr Laura Bambrick, social policy officer with ICTU, and Cormac Lucy, economics columnist at the Sunday Times. And to you first, Laura. So obviously it's wall-to-wall budget speculation, two sleeps until the budget. Can you maybe paint a picture for us of where we're starting to see common ground? Like, we've had months of kite flying about the budget. Where do you think it's now coming into focus in terms of, yeah, these are probably things you can kind of nail on for budget day?
That's right, Anya. It's the most wonderful time of the year for us budget lovers. So what's really surprising is how much we don't know. Usually with two sleeps to go, all that's left to be revealed is the colour of the minister's tie. But really, I think with the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach out of the country for the last week, there is a lot of last minute haggling to do. So a lot of late nights expected over tonight and Monday, and you know, by Tuesday morning we will know. So
and we'll come to where some of that haggling is going to happen, particularly around the job seekers allowance, shortly. But based on what you're seeing across the newspapers, do you think there is now alignment between the coalition partners on things like the universal charge, some of the tax cuts, how they're thinking about maybe things like child benefit?
Yeah, so if we look at the taxation packages, some of the known knowns we know that will be of interest to listeners, that the USC 4% rate on incomes between 25 and 70,000, that will go down to 3%. And the standard rate tax band, that's the amount of money you can earn and pay at the lower 20% rate, that's going to go up an additional €2,000, bringing that up to €44,000. So if you're an average earner, if you're earning in and around 50,000, those two measures alone will be worth around 650 euros over the course of the year. A lot of speculation about inheritance tax in the lead up to that. We knew on the cards there was going to be an exemption around the amount of money a parent to child or child to parent can inherit. That's been more or less confirmed. It will move from 335,000 to 400,000. What's interesting today is it's speculated that all thresholds will see a rise. So that's if you are a beneficiary from an aunt, from a sibling, from a non-relative, you will see an increase in your tax-free limit. Other tax measures that listeners will be interested in, the rent relief, that will increase from 750 to 1,000. Interestingly, that will be for this year and next. Mortgage interest relief, that's going to be extended for a year. And the 9% VAT, the Department of Enterprise is one of those departments where it's just tumbleweed coming from it. We haven't heard anything. But I guess, as you mentioned there, on the other end, for people that are reliant on social welfare, this is where we're seeing a little more about division. And there's a lot of speculation in the papers. Not surprising, Department of Social Protection is the largest spending department. So a lot of focus would be.
We're going to come back to what they still have to haggle on at tonight's negotiations, apparently. Cormac, Lucy, to bring you in, Laura's describing it as the most wonderful time of the year. Do you think there is something in this for everyone in the audience? What are your impressions of it this morning?
It's a pre-election budget. So there's a massive tension between economic interests, which would argue in a very hot economy for giving away less, versus political interests, which weeks before general election possibly would argue for giving away more. I think a lot of the coverage of the budget is from the perspective of us as consumers. What are we getting? Rather than from the perspective of us as citizens. Does this make sense? And the Sunday Business Post has a front page headline, 28 billion budget day bonanza. Government spending this year is going to be 125 billion. So the budget day splurge is going to be 22% of total government spending. It's absolutely enormous at a time when the economy is on fire. Wage increases last year averaged 9.2%.
So you don't think it's the right approach? You agree with the Fiscal Advisory Council in terms of there should be a little bit more of a rainy day fund here and a little bit more reticence?
I would. I think one of the things that we as citizens don't fully understand is our economic dependence on the multinational sector. I estimate that that sector, directly and indirectly, is responsible for over 60% of total tax receipts. And it is the prosperity of that sector that is giving the government the cash to allow for this. But the Fiscal Advisory Council has warned that a lot of those tax revenues are not stable, are not things we should be relying on to build up long-term spending obligations. And I would agree with them that the government should show more restraint.
Ray, to bring you in there, Ray Murphy, do you think this is the right approach when you look across the papers this morning of go big?
No, I mean, I actually agree with Cormac. My sense is why appoint experts to an advisory fiscal council and have other expert bodies give you advice and then totally disregard
it? Yes, the government's prerogative.
Of course,
it's the
government's prerogative, but you should listen to the advice of those who have real expertise, and we shouldn't be driven by short term issues such as elections. So I'll take just one small example: the energy subsidy. You know, I'm likely to get an energy subsidy. I do not need an energy subsidy.
Do you think it should be means tested?
I do think it should be means tested. And all those subsidies should be targeted at the poorest and the most vulnerable. They shouldn't be just, as one reporter said in one of the newspapers this morning, like it's like the Late Show, there's something for everybody in the audience. No, we must be more strategic, we must be more careful. And everything in life, I'm older than everybody else.
Do you accept the argument that sometimes when you start means testing some of these benefits, it's children who suffer, and therefore, given how complicated it is sometimes to means test, you are better off with a catch-all, cast the net out and hope it does target the most marginalised in society?
But if you if you decide on a policy that targets the children that are marginalised, the children that are in special needs, the children that the large number of children that we've recently learned are in poverty, then I think that is what the government is supposed to do. That's what we have civil servants and public servants. So we have a responsibility to those people. And to suggest that giving it to everybody, it trickles down to the most needy, I don't think is a good strategy.
Lord, do you think there are scenarios where we should means test rather than leaving it as universal?
Well, I think overall that looking at this budget, it is reckless. There's no looking away from it. It is going to be about 7% over last year, so breaks the national spending rule. That's a self-imposed rule. We've never delivered on it, but it's there to avoid the boom and bust. And those are the income groups that are reliant on the state for their weekly wages, which will suffer most in the long term when we inevitably go to the bus. And we will hear a lot in the next few days of government using our own money to bribe us with. Well, that's the best case scenario. What they're doing is it's so inflationary that they're giving us more money to be able to buy the things that we have now at inflated prices, just to stand still.
Grunion, the aid to bring you in there, Laura's describing it as reckless, but obviously the government are going to come out and talk very positively of their ability and capacity to now put money back in people's pockets. Are you seeing consensus emerge? How do you think the government will try and frame this budget this week?
Before, because we knew the spending rule would be breached when the summer economic statement was published in July, and Pascal Donoghue said in response to that that they are coming under pressure from all sides to, you know, on the one side, economists are saying spend carefully because the economy is doing so well, full employment, surplus after surplus, etc. And on the other hand, they are coming under pressure from all these different groups to say we want more for our area to progress, our area to help the people that we look after, and that the budget is trying to find a line in the middle.
And is there a balance stances. You think they are trying to hit?
It is difficult to see how. You know, we saw, for example, the ESRI released that report that said 30,000 more children are deprived of basic essentials such as clothes and food. And I don't see something in this that tackles child poverty in particular. I know there will be a double payment to the child benefit before Christmas, but a long-term tackling of that issue. And that is something Simon Harris himself has said they were investigating. I think he said it at the Ploughing Championships that he was meeting with staff to look at this issue of child poverty. And I don't see a creative or long-term strategy to deal with that. Instead, we are seeing something that really worries economists, which is where you are increasing spending while also cutting taxes, which is a red flag. And the IFAC, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, has said that there are some parallels to how the economy is behaving now and the noughties before the crash, that there are multiple surpluses that did not save us during the economic downturn, and that there is a reliance on one sector. So, for example, if two or three multinationals were to pull out of Ireland, then you have more people on social welfare, you have less income tax to rely on, and it could really shake foundations that we are all the papers are talking about how we spend this additional.
I guess we'll have to wait to see, is there some rainy day fund that is being set aside for all of those scenarios and mitigations that you're talking about. So we can see some broad alignment, and Laura Bambrick, where we can see that there isn't alignment, and it's across all of the newspapers today, is around Job Seekers Allowance. And it would seem, based on reporting, Fine Gael is advocating for lower hikes there, and Fianna Fáil Green Party pushing against this and saying, no, we should try and kind of do this fairly and equally. Do you agree with the Greens?
Absolutely
Fianna Fáil?
Not. Oh, sorry, about the differentiation of it. No, and I tell you, people that aren't as invested in this, haven't been, you know, reading it since the summer economic statement and following the budget process, we don't see budget as a day, you know, it's a 6 month event. They will be scanning the papers today and say, oh, well, I can see the argument. You know, we're at full employment. Every business in every sector is looking for people to work. Why are there people unemployed? employed, and we should, you know, give a reduced amount. So it does two things. It plays into the myths that welfare is too generous and there's no incentive to get a job. But my main concern about it, and I would appeal to people when they scan in the newspaper today, to remember that when the economic downturn comes, and as sure as night follow day, it will, under social welfare regulation, you are considered long-term unemployed if you don't have a job after 6 to 9 months when your contribution ends. So people who have been in the workforce for the last 20 years, the 2 million plus public or private sector workers, are you willing to take the bet in the next downturn that you will get a much reduced, it's already only at 232 euros. So this is not something that is, you know, just targeting the dole lifers. You know, people have this image. This is an attack on 2+ million private sector workers.
Cormac Lucy, do you agree with that? Do you think it is pitting people against each other, or do you understand the Fine Gael rationale for doing a lower hike to job seekers' allowance?
Yes and yes. There's a finite amount of resources, so groups are inevitably going to be pitted against one another. But if you study ESRI studies looking into poverty, they would analyse and say that our tax and welfare systems are highly redistributive. So they tax high earners very aggressively. They have significant welfare for the lowest paid. And that means that our post-tax, post-welfare inequality is round about European levels, even though we have much higher inequality in market incomes. And they found in 2020 that the key driver of inequality in Ireland was not wage inequality, but the high proportion of people without any market incomes at all. And if we have a sizzling employment market, if wages rose by 9.2% last year, I think there's a strong argument that we should be relying less on job permits, bringing people in from abroad. We should be requiring our employers to spend much greater resources training our own people up for those jobs, and try to A, get more people into the workforce, B, reduce poverty, and C, do that without adding to housing market pressures.
I was just going to say that when you look at those jobless household numbers, first of all, we've had a massive recovery. So we're at Eurozone averages. At one time, we were an outlier. But the majority of jobless households are people that are on a disability payment. They're not on a long-term unemployment payment, because our social welfare system doesn't recognise the additional cost to disability. We're quite good. Now we have a lot of schemes now to help employers adapt their workplace for a person with a disability. But you know, if you can't use active travel, if you can't use the Luas and the train, getting through to work has a cost. And if you've been out of the workforce for a long time, the likelihood is that you are coming in on a minimum wage or close to minimum wage. So there's a disconnect between looking at jobless households as all, you know, long-term unemployed. These are people that are actually out of the labour market. They're not even counted in it. And then we also have a significant number of women with young children. Again, why is that? Two reasons: the cost of childcare, but because our tax and welfare system prioritises women staying at home to look after children. So if you want to go the full spectrum of getting more, you know, bringing down that jobless level, you know, you are saying things like individualization, like we should go follow the
McCreevy way. Bring you in there. How do you kind of look at that tension that Fine Gael, the Greens, Fianna Fáil are going to have to confront tonight when it comes to attracting more people, of course, back into the workforce? But of course, for all the reasons Laura has just described, there is a certain inevitability to this, and we have to future-proof
for a future day where we could just have recessionary impacts?
Well, first, I'll acknowledge I don't have the expertise of my two colleagues here. But I mean, I would agree with Laura. And
That's okay. You know enough.
You know, we must tackle inequality. And, you know, for example, it changes the subject somewhat. You know, I'm happy to see the changes in inheritance tax. But in some ways, wealth inheritance is something that perpetuates economic inequality. And so I actually think that wealth tax on inheritance is an important equalizer. So I think we have to, you know, anything that pits especially marginalized groups against each other is a negative and should not be done. And so I would support Laura's advocacy for example, women who want to go back into the workplace, for greater childcare, and for more progressive welfare towards people who are long-term not in the job market.
Gráinne, to bring you back in, Gráinne na Hig, Shane Coleman this morning was making the point about, you know, there needs to be more ambition and vision and creative ideas and innovative ideas. And he was making the point, you know, Charlie McCreevy tried something with decentralisation, whether it worked or not, and how all of that played out. But do you think we will see maybe some surprises come budget day? Or do you think, no, kites have been flown, we're seeing largely how it's going to land now?
No, I think a lot about the significance of the budget. And a lot of the time it is about keeping the country ticking over. It is not where big ideas come forward. It is not where big social changes happen. It is about just making sure that, as the Ministers for Finance and Public Expenditure have said, we are keeping up with the cost of running our public services. And that is, there will be an increase every year. And I think that's one of the tricky things, that they will have to increase thresholds to a certain amount because everything has become more expensive. And the whole system needs to reflect that in order that the average worker and the average person in Ireland is not losing out just because they're earning the same amount and costs have changed. But I think it is not a place where big surprises happen. I think when it is read out in the Dáil, generally everyone is aware of what's happening. There is very little reaction. The opposition generally don't react to much because they know everything that is coming. And there is quite a muted response, particularly when it is so generous. It is hard to argue. But, you know, one community worker I spoke to last year who works with, you know, in disadvantaged area, said that it was one for everyone in the audience, and that when the country is doing so well, we should be trying to lift up those that are struggling the most to a minimum threshold, as well as, you know, progressive changes for the average worker. And there's we can understand why politicians are appealing to the middle class as well. But if we have all these surpluses and we are not making more people less poor, what is the point?
And Laura, just finally, you were looking at Business Post, Daniel Murray, Apple windfall. It's just one of a number of money trees government can shake for funds to feed the economy. What else will you be looking out for in the coming days? Maybe when it comes to small businesses, maybe when it comes to, we talked about child poverty earlier. Are there others that you feel yet to come that are going to be key ingredients for this budget to work?
Yeah, I'll be very interested in the Department of Enterprises budget package. So will they be able to strike that balance of being able to support businesses with the additional cost of doing business and not lead workers to carry that cost. So very concerned that we haven't heard anything about the low pay recommendation for the minimum wage. Usually going on all previous years, the low pay commission's report, their recommendation for the appropriate rate for the new year would be published, you know, before the Cabinet broke for summer. Usually a decision is taken, if not in the summer, the 1st of September. And we know, again, tumbleweed from it. We're not hearing anything about, you know, the 9% VAT. So there could be a reasoning for it that he wants to announce it as the full package. This is what you have to do for workers, but this is the way we're going to support. But really concerned that, is this going to be the first minister to reject a low pay commission recommendation on the minimum wage? And that's some legacy to go to the country with, given all the surplus that we have.
Cormac Lucy, I'm going to give you the final word here on budgets. Anything you want to leave us with that you're looking for that will try and get a holistic, good budget for all come Tuesday?
This is going to be a political splurge and there will be election surprises. You know, if you're Jack Chambers and this might be the only budget you ever give, you're going to want to have a distinct personal imprint. So I wouldn't be surprised if he has got something in his bag that people say, wow, isn't Jack Chambers a great guy? But the economic backdrop to all of this is all being funded by highly vulnerable multinational revenues we're getting. We are not even debating that. It's eerily reminiscent of the property bubble, where there were a handful of people warning, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 that we were vulnerable. People, it was too unpleasant to admit such a thing. It's too unpleasant today to admit that we might be vulnerable on the multinational front. And we need to develop indigenous enterprise so that if the multinational thing recedes, we're not left
completely
exposed.
Contingency planning, we're doing enough for sustainable local jobs here in Ireland. Okay, you've been listening to Ray Murphy, Gráinne Nieg, Laura Bambrake and Cormac Lucy. We'll be back after these.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
RTE Radio 1.
The Valley of the Squinting Windows, Michael Scott's ingenious sellout play, returns to the Gaiety Theatre. Nominated for an Irish Times Theatre Award and based on Brinsley McNamara's scandalous novel, this story of God, bigotry and vengeance will have you on the edge of your seat. Trading in wild theatricality, it's impossible to resist. The Valley of the Squinting Windows at the Gaiety Theatre from October 28th for 1 week only with 3 matinees. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie.
Entertainment updates on RTE Radio 1.
Your GP is with you at every stage of your healthcare journey, from pregnancy care and baby vaccines to the most serious of conditions. Your GP is with you, providing continuous healthcare. Over 4,400 GPs in Ireland provide more than 20 million consultations annually. Your GP is with you, supported by the Irish College of GPs.
Home Instead caregivers make a difference.
We took out my crochet. I actually still have the knack.
Home Instead. To us, it's personal.
A visit to Ideal Bathroom's stunning showrooms in Dublin will show you the quality of your choices, including luxury brands such as Villeroy and Boch, with over 100 bathroom displays on show, and of course, help from our expert staff. Ideal Bathrooms, the ultimate bathroom experience. Sale now on Ideal Bathrooms. Ideally, everyone should have one.
At the heart of every successful business are highly skilled and talented people. That's why at Skillnet Ireland, we know that every skill counts. Whatever sector your business operates in, and whatever skills you or your business needs, contact one of our 70 Skillnet business networks for training and development that's industry-led and can improve your business success. Visit skillnetireland.ie for upskilling and reskilling supports to develop your team. Skillnet Ireland is a business support agency of the Government of Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. My newspaper panel are still here. Ray Murphy, Gráinne Nieg, Laura Bambrake and Cormac Lucy. Ray, you've been looking a lot at the Middle East coverage. Obviously, escalating crisis there throughout the week and months, and obviously culminating this week then in the killing of Nasrallah. Could you maybe just remind us of the significance of Hassan Nasrallah and his assassination this week?
Yeah, well, Hassan Nasrallah has been the leader of Hezbollah since the early 90s. And he's both the spiritual and political leader. He's a man of exceptional charisma. Now, I don't say that as a person who admired him in any way, but he was very politically strategic in his thinking and his actions. And he had a huge following in South Lebanon amongst the Shia population there. So his loss will be immeasurable. And along with the loss of Nasrallah, a large echelon of the Hezbollah leadership has been taken out, both in the assassination of Nasrallah, because he was meeting in the headquarters in Beirut with a number of other leaders. And then during the week, we're all familiar with the explosive pages that also disabled or killed a number of the leaders. And the command and control structures within Hezbollah were quite strong. So it is a unified group. It doesn't rely on so-called cell structures, so that it will be hard for it to continue. And the Israeli military action has also, I'm sure, destroyed significant amounts of the Hezbollah's military hardware.
And Ria, you have served as a military officer in the Irish Defence Forces. You've done two tours of duty in Lebanon. When you now reflect on those attacks on Hamas, those attacks on Hezbollah, and the state now of that region, the fears for a regional war, the fears of a ground incursion into Lebanon, how do you forecast out from here of where this goes to next?
Yeah, that's quite hard to say. I mean, I would remind the listeners that really Hezbollah became into the ascendancy in 1982 when the Israelis invaded South Lebanon. Up to then, it didn't have significant power, but it became the strongest militant group in the region as a direct consequence of Israeli policy in South Lebanon during its occupation. And that was not something that was foreseen. And so when you embark on a military campaign such as we have currently in the Gaza Strip against Hamas, but also really against the Palestinian population, and now the campaign that's being launched into South Lebanon, we do not know what the consequences are. And one of the ironies of the loss of Nasrallah is that he was an astute political actor, and he might have been able to, in a way, the Israelis have set a trap for Hezbollah, because it's in the Israelis' interest that Hezbollah now respond forcefully to what has happened. And that might drag in Iran, the Houthis in Yemen. And the United States has already come to the defence of Israel in this current round of hostilities. It's committed to doing so again. It would suit the purposes of the Israelis to try to take out Hamas, Hezbollah, and substantially weaken Iran in the broader context. But we do not know the long-term consequences of this conflict. Any conflict, the first rule, I can't think of the principles of military action, is that you plan for action, for contact with the enemy. But as soon as you make contact,
And then we're watching to see what Iran does next. Gráinne Nieg, you were looking at a piece in the Sunday Times with the headline, "We Face the Hellish Prospect of Middle East in Flames."
Yeah, it talks about the escalation over the past few days. I suppose, during the week, in a pre-interview for the show, the question was, are we on the brink? And even since then, the escalation has completely
accelerated
to extreme heights. Netanyahu giving a speech at the UN saying we are not going to stop, extraordinary. The pagers incident, extraordinary. And now the leader of Hezbollah, as Ray was saying, by even the critics of Hezbollah, they called him a rational leader. And now we are looking at someone who will come into the brink to replace him, who will be after revenge most likely. So it is a completely volatile situation which international diplomacy has failed. One of the points that is made is how vital Joe Biden's role has been in this, in terms of how soft a US president he has been, and that has stopped escalations. The other point that is being made in this piece in the Sunday Times is that Iran will be looking mostly at trying to protect its nuclear weapons. Any long range missiles that it would give to Hezbollah would leave it vulnerable to protect its own arsenal, and that might be the thing that stops things escalating. But we don't know. So many things you couldn't have predicted about this week, and it is happening so fast. The amount of people killed, over 1,000 in Lebanon, thousands more displaced. So it's really hard to see how it doesn't get worse from here.
And Cormac Lucy, on that question of any prospect for peace, for negotiations, we're 5 weeks out from a US election. You were looking at the piece in the Sunday Times by Mark Urban. One hot war, the other one frozen. Biden's inaction has played key role in both. This is part of Joe Biden's legacy between now and January and a transfer of power. Do you see any possibility of negotiation and diplomatic channels working?
No. One of the striking things is how Israel has
taken major, made major strategic moves without informing the Americans. That this action in the last fortnight in the Lebanon being a major example. And I think one of the main questions that Israel needs to confront is they're winning all of these tactical military victories, but their strategic predicament of how does this end in peace is getting worse and worse. And Ray just mentioned that maybe Nasrallah could have been a building block for peace. It was interesting that in the Northern Ireland conflict, it appears that the British targeted for killing hardliners in the IRA to ease the path for those who might preach peace, such as Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. And the deeper back problem, the big backdrop to all of this, there's too much annihilatory hatred on both sides. And however bad things got in the Northern Troubles, you didn't see bomb attacks of Catholic churches or Protestant churches. Things were brutal and they were bad, but there wasn't an annihilatory ambition or a sense that there might be one from the actions of either side. But that's what we're seeing right now.
Ray Murphy, do you think there's any pathway to peace negotiations, but it'll take till post-US elections? Nothing will happen in the next 5 weeks. Have you any cause for optimism?
No, I don't have any cause for optimism. I don't see that the United States has been all that weak in its involvement in the Middle East. It's actually been the major supplier of weapons to Israel. The Biden administration only last week, despite everything that we've witnessed in Gaza, has announced another $8 billion package, military package, to support Israel. That is shocking. That's direct complicity in the war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the genocide that's
there's no
place.
Surprise in that US position. It's entirely consistent with how it has always supported Israel, regardless of political
party, no surprise,
or US president.
But that doesn't make it any less palatable. It doesn't make it right. And Israel has been remarkably successful in its attack against Hamas and now against Hezbollah. And I don't say that, you know, in admiration of what I've done, but I just acknowledge a fact. And, you know, we have allowed over the last almost year now, we are witnesses to what has happened in Gaza. And there hasn't been any sanction. Israel, Netanyahu and his government have not been made to account.
So does it raise real questions of institutions like the UN, which obviously received huge coverage and headlines all week, that there's a state of powerlessness amongst the political establishments world over to do something right now?
Yes, there is. But I mean, the UN will only ever be as good as the states that make up its membership allow it to be. Like, it isn't the UN that's at fault. It's the manipulation of the UN, the institutions of the UN, especially by the major powers. But the point about what's happened in Gaza is that Netanyahu and his government now feel they can get away with anything and will continue to do so until we make them hold them to account and until there is a price to pay. And that has to be by the European Union, the United States. And the European Union must forge an independent foreign policy in relation to this conflict.
When I said the US has been weak, what I meant was when you're looking at Netanyahu and Joe Biden, Netanyahu looks like the more powerful leader, which
yes.
is an extraordinary situation. And
but the
dynamic.
US has leverage.
It
is
does.
Is it leveraged unused right now, or leverage that is just...
I think its approach has been to be a friend to Israel and to talk them down in a friendly manner as much as they can. Joe Biden, or the US administration, has said that a red line would be a ground invasion in Lebanon. But his red lines have been so porous before that that doesn't seem to rule out it as an option. That is, they're poising themselves, the Israeli army, on the edge of that border for a ground incursion. Whether it happens or not is one thing, but to be preparing it when the US said this is a red line for us is an extraordinary example of how weak the US is here.
Ray, just final word on it, like to your point about accountability. Like, who can hold accountability here and how do you do it? Is it sanctions? Is it going to take US withdrawing funding that they do eventually hit the red line that Grania is talking about?
Well, first I'd say sanctions. I mean, nationally we have two legislative proposals. One is it's the Occupied Territories Bill and the Israeli Legal Settlements Divestments Bill that are languishing in the Houses of the Eretz. We could adopt those pieces of legislation and we should do so. They're very piecemeal. It's not going to have a major impact.
Ireland's such a small player.
But we do support it. Yeah, but we have recognised the state of Palestine. We nonetheless have a voice within the European Union. And I think even countries like Germany that give unconditional support to Israel have now had to rethink that policy in the light of the last 12 months. But it's important to support institutions like the International Criminal Court. That is one institution that I have some faith in. And while I don't ever believe Netanyahu or the other government ministers are going to be actually physically before that court, the very fact of being indicted and an arrest warrant for those individuals will be a very strong signal. And therefore, I think that is the only hope we have in the short term to hold those individuals to account.
Okay, no doubt. A story we will keep coming back to in the hours, days, weeks, months to come. We're going to be back in a moment with election speculation and more.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
White's important Irish art auction is on view this week. See exceptional works by Jackie Yates, Paul Henry, Mildred Ann Butler, William Orpin, Mary Swansea, Rowan Gillespie and many others. On view this week at 38 Molesworth Street and online at whites.ie. Whites, where Irish art is truly valued.
We pushed on, scrabbling up the slope, slipping on loose rocks. Feet blistered, hands grazed from grabbing the sharp edges. But what of you? Forget the backyard. We were conquerors of Croke Patrick.
No one understands adventure like Medicare. That's why for 35 years, families have been choosing our quality first aid to make every adventure better. Recommended by your local pharmacy, trusted in homes. For the people who dare, there's Medicare.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. Now, lots of election date speculation today and lots of continued emphasis on the spending at the National Children's Hospital. But first, on all of the political correspondence around the political corridors of power, Gráinne, in which you frequent, there's a great piece on page 10 of the Sunday Independent today with two nice theories. There's the pizza meter theory and there's the meaningful Christmas theory, both of which are being used by political reporters to try and judge the election date.
Yeah, Gabia Gathafitzgaitha has a great piece where there was another theory. She basically has a tongue-in-cheek look at the election dates because it has become almost farcical how obsessive the calculations have been going on about when an election could be held. So she mentions the Guy Fawkes Immaculate Conception theory, which is that it would be held between Guy Fawkes Night, November 5th, and the Feast of the Immaculate Conception on December 8th. The pizza meter theory, which is a mirror of the Pentagon pizza meter theory, which is monitoring deliveries, food deliveries to a government building and trying to predict how active basically government is after hours based on that. And then there is the meaningful Christmas theory, in which he said Fianna Fáilers are wondering what it would be like to be re-elected in time for Christmas and if that means that we're going to have a meaningful Christmas. So it is a fun piece about how much the speculation. My favourite line in it is actually where she says that one TD said they were planning for November 8th as their posters are due to come in around that time. This date is unfavourable, is said to be unfavourable for Fine Gael as Ireland will play New Zealand and the rugby watching voters will not bother to head to the ballot box before the match.
Yeah. If you had to call it, Gráinne, Give us a date or at least a bracket. Do you think
I think it'll be November for several reasons. One is the less time the government gives Sinn Féin to bounce back after the local elections, the better in their eyes. Another is after the full term means the amount of budget this budget that they wanted to deliver the budgets under the programme for government, which they will have done. And another is that Leinster House is quite quiet at the moment. At one stage, I looked around the Dáil canteen.
You know, when you say that out loud, Gráinne, as a political reporter.
It was full of TDs who are not running in the next general election. So I think that all politicians are preparing
the ground.
Exactly.
In the constituency.
But, you know, why this is important, because I'm aware that listeners are probably listening to this being like, why do we care? It could be crucial in deciding who comes back into government, whether it's Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and another party, whether it's just Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, whether it's a Sinn Féin government. And that is why why we're kind of obsessed about
it. And the question of a Sinn Féin government, Laura Bambrick, you've been looking at the Sinn Féin Ardèche coverage in the Mail on Sunday and the Sunday Independent. In the Mail on Sunday, they report how Sinn Féin's going to field 70 candidates. I think one, at least one in every single constituency is the plan there. But there was an interesting proposal from leader Mary MacDonald yesterday when it came to how she might go about executing on a border poll and a minister for reunification.
Yeah, so I was surprised at how sparse the coverage of the Sinn Féin Ardèche was. You know, they're our main opposition party. It could be that they were unlucky with the weekend, a budget weekend, but you'd usually expect to see Mary Lou on her own or with Michelle leading the front page. So very sparse coverage. So their two big ticket items were, as you said, that Minister of State for Reunification and a universal carer's allowance. So getting away from the means testing. So look, I understand the leaders, the leaders' speeches, you know, after the 6 o'clock news. So there is little time for political correspondents to do an analysis. Really, what we got in the two papers were the headlines, the things she touched on. But you know, sitting at the comfort of home, the thing that jumped out to me is her speech was really talking to people who feel left behind, that the state has failed them. They failed them either on housing or medical or family carers. And but there was very little there for, you know, people that are getting by. They're not necessarily living the high life, living on the hog, but, you know, they have a mortgage. It's probably higher than they would like. They have a good job, probably with a multinational. They are paying childcare. Maybe they would like to, they certainly would like to pay less, but they do recognise the tax relief that they will get. They recognise the significant deductions in child benefits. And I wonder, has she done enough to give comfort to that group of people that, yes, we want to look at the left behind, but this will not come at your cost? And I think it was a real indication of the cleavage, the division lines we're going to see around this election. People that want to continue on the course that we're in, small incremental change or a real
I think
reset.
To Sinn Féin's credit this week, when they talked about their own alternative budget, they really did try to position it as they were doing various different measures to try and ensure those who are most disadvantaged, marginalised, also middle classes would benefit. But I guess we will have to see how that maybe plays out and choose up against the Sinn Féin alternative budget versus the government and the final analysis there. One thing I imagine that the government will be keen to try and tidy up before maybe an election is called is the ongoing controversy, Cormac, Lucy, around the cost of the National Children's Hospital. That's rumbling on today. The Sunday Independent is splashing with a story there, supposedly and reportedly, of how Stephen Donnelly wrote to the BAM board, but the Dutch overarching mothership really about the delays at the hospital and bypassing the leadership team here. What did you make of that story? Do you think it's an important intervention?
It's utterly unimportant. It's a contrived insertion of news by Stephen Donnelly to show that he's worried about the issue. But the notion that him speaking to the parent company board in Holland is going to move anything significant when there are hundreds of pages of contracts behind what's happened, when we're 10 years down the road on this project, it's just fanciful. And it's a little bit, there's another similar story in the same paper where James Lawless, the junior minister for transport, said he almost walked out of a meeting with Ryanair. And it's, you know, I'm the big man standing up for the public against these big corporate interests. I won't be pushed around. But where's the beef? Where is the actual result for citizens that shows that these effects are any more than PR fluff to boost the images of the ministers?
When you look at the coverage today and you look at the headline figures and we look at the years and years of delays, what is happening here, Cormac Lucy, when it comes to accountability, when it comes to tracking of taxpayers, citizens' money in big projects like this? Is there something just going wrong in the initial scoping exercises to understand the scale of the ambition of a hospital, of an M50, of a port tunnel? Because we seem to kind of repeat.
There are several problems. There's a lack of responsibility. So we still don't have the name of any public servant standing over the Leinster House bicycle shelter. We don't really have a name for somebody standing, other than the ministers, for somebody standing over the National Children's Hospital. There's an absence of strong incentives within the public service. So if you do a fantastic job and bring the project in under cost, under time, you'll get paid exactly the same as if, in the case of the National Children's Hospital, the project is going to cost five or six times what was originally budgeted, and it's going to take two or three times as long to deliver. There's an overweighting of communications, like the two stories concerning Ministers Donnelly and Lawless, over substantive performance. Like, if you look at the UK, just to take us offshore for a minute, Laura Kunzberg, the BBC's top political editor, she's paid over twice as much as the British Prime Minister. And you see that here in this country as well. I won't be so rude as to name names. You've got a public spending code. Colin McCarthy has been writing about this in the web pages of The Currency. That's generally disregarded. And in Britain, they have this problem too. There's a chap called Sam Friedman who's written a very good book, Failed State, Why Nothing Works and Why We Fix It. So I think there's just a
not
lack of
unique to Ireland. We see this world over, don't we? Yeah. Rhea, you were looking at this as well, and the billions spent and yet to come and delayed timelines. Like, how does it sit with you this morning watching some of those headlines around the hospital timelines?
Yeah, to link it into what we were talking about Sinn Féin, because I did listen to Mary Lou last night, at least most of what she said. And I mean, I found the housing policy proposal, at least it was bold and imaginative. I don't know if it's going to work. But none of the parties have presented me with something that will fix the health crisis. And for me, in my age bracket, and having last year actually been seriously ill and having an emergency admission to the university hospital in Galway, and experience firsthand what it's like to be on a corridor with many other people, it's just totally dysfunctional. So I don't care about the bicycle shed, Leinster House. That's just a storm in a teacup. I do care about BAM. I do care about the major capital programmes that are costing the state an enormous amount and we're not getting these progressed and finished on time. But I don't know what the solution to the health service is. But if you know, I have private health insurance, I had to go to the public hospital because it was a complicated situation. But you can't capture just how bad the experience
and what was the trolleys. Experience? Were you on a trolley for large parts of your time?
Or? Initially, I was in a glass cubicle where for about 36 hours I was being monitored closely, and as medical staff passed by, they could instantly tell how I was doing. But as soon as I stabilised, I went out to a corridor for a number of days and nights.
On a trolley. For days.
Yeah. But I think it was captured for me by about 3 a.m. one morning. There was a very old woman across from me in the corridor, and she didn't know where she was. She was visibly distressed. She was speaking to what I assumed was her son, Anthony, who wasn't there. And she was pleading, "Why won't you help me, Anthony?" I tried to get the attention of the medical staff to kind of assist her. I was physically unable to move myself, so I couldn't get up out of bed to hold her hand and reassure her or do something human. But to me, it's unacceptable after decades of the expenditure that we've had on health and all the talks and policies and reorganisation of the HSE and etc. and all that. But the experience on the ground is still awful.
And there's space and logistics and how the money is spent. And yet, I think to a person, everyone will always commend the effort of doctors and nurses and those in those hospital settings. One other heading, like from the billions around hospitals and healthcare to the billions being spent in the United States when it comes to the election. Cormac, you were looking at this headline figure from Murray McKeown in the Business Post today. $16 billion is what the election is topping out at over in the US at the moment.
I suspect this may well be a factor why America is so supportive of Israel. I think American politics is financially corrupted by so much money with no limits on how much money can be invested and a complete lack of clarity as to where this money is ultimately coming from. There was an article in the Washington Post in 2015 headlined "Inside the $3 billion Clinton Donor Network." So there's a real danger that people in office are giving policy concessions to people on the understanding that when they leave office, they'll receive financial benefits. And this money, 16 billion and counting for the American election. In Ireland, you're certainly in the local elections, individual donors were limited to 1,000 euros donation. That was the top they could
give. Yeah, so we have to watch to see what are the unintended consequences, perhaps, of a 16 billion price tag. Gráinne Stealing with US, you were looking at a piece in the Sunday Independent with Declan Lynch. Media cleaned up Charlie, now they're tidying Trump. There was a little bit of media cleansing around some of the Trump language, I think, playing out with the New York Times and others.
Yeah, I like this piece because it was kind of a thoughtful kind of analysis on how we cover bizarre comments in the media. So one of the things he makes the point of is that, you know, there is a certain amount of tidying quotes. For example, when you're speaking, you might say, you know, or like, or that as a crutch to give you more time to speak. But he was like, you know, if you're the New York Times, which published hundreds of articles about this, how senile or Joe Biden's mental ability, it doesn't look good to be then putting a thumb on the scales this way for his unhinged opponent. And then he compares this to an interview 40 years ago with Charlie Haughey in Hot Press, where he gave this expletive laden interview to John Waters, which was recorded and the tape recorder was on the table. And then it created a crisis the next day for PJ Mara, his right-hand man, when people realised how much Charlie Haughey swears all the time, basically, and how there is an obligation to kind of parse this. You know, he makes the point that, you know, for certain politicians who do not recognise the authority of any media to determine what is true or false, and are mainly talking to their own followers, you have to be somewhat analytical and critical and not just report as straight or do the politicians' work for them and make them make sense, which I think is an interesting one because Trump is so rambly. And if you looked at a transcript of his quotes and tried to put that into a coherent piece, you wouldn't be able to.
And just finally, Gráinne Nieg, you were looking at some of the coverage of Maggie Smith, from Shakespeare to Harry Potter and everything in between. Very quickly, any standout moment for you of Maggie?
There was a gorgeous piece by Simon Callow in the Sunday Times, and he just this one anecdote about how, you know, he was saying she was brilliant, she was so versatile, so gifted, somewhat overshadowed by her parts in Harry Potter and big roles like that. But he said in one production that was kind of a disaster, she got sick one week and the news was told to her that another colleague of hers had broken his arm to add to the disasters of the production. And she said, as he writes, whose wit never entirely deserted her, said, well, that's one less wrist to be slapped.
And the final word to you, Gráinne Nieg, news reporter with the Press Association. My thanks also to Dr. Laura Bamrick, social policy officer with ICTU, Cormac Lucy, economics columnist at the Sunday Times, and Professor Ray Murphy, UN peacekeeper now at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. My thanks to all of you.